Thank you. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Celeste Bartos Education Center at the New York Public Library. For those of you whom I haven't had the pleasure of meeting so far, my name is Paul LeClaire, and I'm the president of the best library in the world, with all due regard to the British Library, the New York Public Library. And on behalf of the co-chair of our wonderful Council of Conservators, Kathy Rayner, Susan Morgenthau, and Robin McNeil, I'm delighted to welcome you this evening to the Celeste Bartos Forum for this wonderful program that we're about to hear. I'd like to take a moment to thank all of you for your generous support as conservators of the library. And if you are not yet a conservator, please do join. This is the single most important group of supporters that we have at the library. Not enough people realize that this is a private library, supported primarily by the private sector. I always think that the name is misleading. It should be the New York Public Library, the New York Private Library, open to the public as a consequence of private philanthropy. So if you enjoy what's happening here and if you care about what we do for the people of the world, either in our libraries or online, become a conservator. It's one of the best investments you can make in keeping New York vital and strong and wonderful. As you may know, this is National Poetry Month, and what better way to celebrate that happy event than to hear readings tonight from the work of two of America's legendary poets, Robert Frost and Robert Lowell. Our guide for tonight's journey is Josephine Hart, best-selling novelist, West End producer, passionate poetry fan, who will be joined by our distinguished readers, actors Brian Dennehy and Mark Strong. Ms. Hart will be introducing Mr. Dennehy and Mr. Strong, and my pleasant task is to introduce her. Josephine Hart is the author of five novels, including Damage, filmed by Louis Malle, Sin, recently produced as a play in Italy, and The Reconstructionist, which was filmed in 2005 by Roberto Ando. She has become one of the great, great champions of poetry in the UK. Ms. Hart founded the Gallery Poets and West End Poetry Hours series, which presented the works of the major poets read by some of Britain's finest actors. 3 years ago, she brought her passion for poetry to public programs of the British Library, where she continues to present her Josephine Hart Poetry Hour series to standing room only audiences. Tonight, we celebrate poetry and the publication of Ms. Hart's new book, Catching Life by the Throat, How to Read a Poem and Why, together with its companion CD. I'm delighted to announce that thanks to Ms. Hart, our library will be receiving 200 copies of Catching Life by the Throat for all of our branch libraries and multiple copies for each one of our branch libraries. Thank you very, very much, Josephine. That's a lovely, lovely gift. Ms. Hart has graciously agreed to sign your books just outside of the auditorium this evening, and I urge you to buy one. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming three wonderful friends of the library and of poetry this evening.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you so much for coming. Thank you, Dr. LeClaire, Paul, if I may, for those generous words and for the warmest of welcomes to this very, very beautiful building. But the beauty is not just skin deep. From the moment I arrived here on Friday, I was astounded by the level of dedication and commitment and passion for the ideal that the library stands for. I want to thank the co-chairs, Kathy Rayner and Susan Morgenthau. I also want to thank Catherine Dunn and Jonathan Burnham, who, when I saw him in London, was saying it would be great. It's going to be wonderful. Above all, I want to thank Fran Schinkel. She has been so consistent in her support, and organizing things transatlantically is really quite a challenge. I also want to thank Norton Publications for publishing this book with the CD. I'm very anxious that it gets into, hopefully, as many schools as possible, as well as into the library. This strange, though lovely, adventure began in England 3 years ago at the British Library. Lenny Goodings of Arago decided that she would publish the book with a CD on which Ralph Fiennes reads Auden, Harold Pinter reads Larkin, Roger Moore reads Kipling, and there are many other readings in the book. Now, because of the generosity of the actors and of Arago and of the British Library, we funded a copy into every school in Britain teaching between 12 and 18-year-olds. Ed Victor, always my good shepherd, believed that this would happen, as did Gráinne Fox, who works for Ed Victor. They've come over especially for this evening, as has Anne Harrod Wood of Tavistock Wood, which is a major acting agency. That is the level of their commitment. I'm so grateful to them. Now, why do we all do this? But what on earth are we trying to do here? Well, poetry is a trinity of sound and sense and sensibility, and the sense of sound, and what Robert Frost called the sound of sense, will be lost unless we hear it. Language caught alive. The gold in the ore, he once said, is of the sound. Seamus Heaney, when he was an undergraduate at Queen's, found Eliot's four quartets daunting. Seamus Heaney found it daunting. You can imagine what it's like for the rest of it. But then Robert Speight came to Queen's and he read it. And Heaney said what had been perplexing when sight read for meaning only was absolutely illuminated by the human voice. Yeats in his 70s said that he'd spent his life clearing out of poetry every line written for the eye alone and bringing all back to syntax, which is for the ear alone. Now, all of the actors you've seen on that list, and really they are an extraordinary group, have read for us for no fee. And they also have to rehearse. We've rehearsed this evening, all of these people, and when we were doing Milton, hours work had to go in. Again, no fee. Their generosity is simply stunning. And tonight is no exception. Mark Strong has travelled from London to be with us this evening. He's one of Britain's leading classical actors at the National Theatre and at the Royal Shakespeare Company. He's a BAFTA and Olivier Best Actor Award nominee. His performance in Sam Mendes' production, which some of you may have seen here, which transferred from the Donmar Warehouse, from London's Donmar Warehouse to New York, is, in my opinion, and the opinion of many, many critics, one of the greatest Chekhov performances of modern times. In TV, he won Best Actor Award in BBC's Long Firm, which you may have seen, and of course his films are well known to you all, Polanski's Oliver Twist, Syriana with George Clooney, and in July, his new film, Flashbacks of a Fool with Daniel Craig, opens. But I must tell you, in every performance, whether it's on television or on the screen or in the theatre, what Mark does is he gives a performance of extraordinary subtle control, and he gets it right every time and all the time. Now, Brian Dennehy, he's paid me a lot of money for that remark. Brian Dennehy, who has starred just lately with Aidan Quinn and David Strathairn in Richard Nelson's Conversations at Tusculum, the Public Theatre. Now, as ever, he won glowing reviews. And this is the problem when trying to introduce Brian Dennehy. Were I to name just the major awards he has won, we could cancel the poetry evening and I could simply sit here listening the most challenging roles in classical theatre, historical and modern. These are just a few. Long Day's Journey in Tonight, Tony Award Best Actor. Death of a Salesman, Tony Award, the Olivia Best Actor in London. This performance of genius also won three other awards. On television, Belly of an Architect, Our Fathers, Showtime, Emmy nomination, Best Supporting Actor. Now, one of his films is called Thanks to a Grateful Nation. It seems to me that this is thanks from a grateful audience. We owe him a lot. I have to stop because he will get very, very embarrassed. But not before I say again, thank you to them. Now, I hope this won't sound impertinent, but I would ask you not to applaud until the end of the evening because we have about 16 poems here. Now, we're going to move on to Robert Frost and Robert Lowell. What connects the tortured, much-married, sophisticated patrician Robert Lowell, who took the fabric of his life and made of it savage poetry, and Frost, the botanizing New England chicken farmer who many believed wrote of old pieties, old virtues, old beliefs? Well, genius, of course, terror, alas, of madness, and adamantine will. Robert Lowell was born on the 1st of March, 1917, to Robert Trail Spence Lowell Sr., who hadn't a mean bone, an original bone, or a funny bone in his body. If he were mine, I'd lobotomize him and stuff his head with green peppers, a relative's cruel remark. His mother was Charlotte Winslow, whose antecedents came over in the Mayflower. He was born into American aristocracy. His immediate family included the Cabots, who talked only to the Lowells, and of course the Lowells talked only to God. According to the eminent critic, English critic John Bailey, the Lowell family itself was a more potent inspiration than any literature. Lowell would seem to agree, looking back over 30 years of published work, the thread that strings the work together is autobiography. Charlotte Winslow, his mother, was a marital manipulator par excellence. She saw her husband as a valet sees through his master. That's a line from Lowell. She dominated him and effectively thwarted his naval career. My father declined, smiling from job to job, until in his 40s his soul went underground. That is a shocking line. It's Lowell's haunting description. Now, even as a child, Lowell wondered, why doesn't father fight back? Nothing was going to thwart the young Lowell. At school, he was nicknamed Caligula, shortened mercifully to Cal. In adolescence and young manhood, his rages, his recklessness were such that help was sought of Dr. Merrill Moore, the poet-psychiatrist, and eventually later from Carl Jung. If your son is as you have described him, he is an incurable schizophrenic. However, within the kingdom of poetry, perhaps Lowell sensed salvation. Certainly from the moment he started writing, age 17, encouraged by the poet teacher Richard Eberhardt, he demonstrated a disciplined intensity and utterly determined will. When warned by the bewildered Alan Tate of New Criticism fame, whom he'd followed from Harvard to Tennessee, "We really haven't any room. You'd have to pitch a tent in the garden," Robert Lowell went out, bought a tent, and pitched it in the garden. At Kenyon College, he dissected poetry down to its seventh and Sunian ambiguity, writing, rewriting every line of his work, a lifelong obsession. In 1946, his collection Lord Wearie's Castle, brilliant, elusive, technically dazzling, difficult. The last line of the celebrated The Quaker's Graveyard at Nantucket, "The Lord survives the rainbow of his will. Don't worry if you don't understand it, neither does anybody else. You just enjoy its beauty." The collection won ecstatic reviews and the Pulitzer Prize. He'd arrived, a literary star. He was 30. In fact, he'd achieved notoriety sometime earlier with a letter to a president. Lowell, who'd volunteered in 1941 and had been turned down due to his eyesight, was drafted in 1943. "Dear Mr. President, I very much regret that I must refuse the opportunity you've afforded me in your communication of August 6, 1943, for services in the armed forces." He attached his declaration of personal responsibility. "We are prepared to wage war without quarter or principles to the permanent destruction of Germany and Japan. I cannot honorably participate in a war whose persecution constitutes the betrayal of my country." It was headline news. Lowell Sion refused to fight. He was sentenced to a year and a day in the Federal Correction Center at Danbury, prior to which, as we will hear, he spent a few days in West Street, in the cell next to Lepke of Murder Incorporated. Lepke was, incidentally, eventually executed, which gives the last line of this poem you will hear in a few minutes. It's shocking power. Lepke to Lowell, "I'm in for killing. What are you in for?" "I'm in for refusing to kill." 22 years later, another letter to a president. The catalyst, Lowell's involvement in 1960s anti-Vietnam demonstrations, during which, according to the late, great Norman Mailer, Lowell had the unwilling, haunted saintliness of a man who was repaying the moral debts of tens of generations of ancestors. That was Mr. Mailer at his most restrained. "Dear President Johnson, we are in danger of imperceptibly becoming an explosive and suddenly chauvinistic nation and maybe even drifting on our way to last nuclear ruin. I feel I am serving you and my country best by not taking part in the White House Festival of the Arts." Now, Lowell's political commitment inspired him to write two of the great political poems of the century, "Waking Early," "Sunday Morning," and "For the Union Dead." And we are going to read "For the Union Dead." It's Lowell's haunting tribute to Colonel Robert Gould Shaw, 25, white, when he laid down his life for a race as he bravely led his black 54 Massachusetts regiment against Fort Wagner in the Civil War. The monument to his heroism is beautifully evoked by Lowell, and the monument, of course, as you all know, is in Boston. Tragically, in his 30s, Lowell tumbled into the abyss of psychosis and was often hospitalized in a straitjacket for his own protection. This was his description of an attack. "I believed I could stop cars merely by standing in the middle of the road, that I was the reincarnation of the Holy Ghost. To have known the glory, violence, and banality of such an experience is corrupting." Waking in the Blue is a love poem from McLean's Mental Hospital. BU stands for Boston University. This is a line in the poem. The meaning of meaning is I, a Richard's book. And Porcellian 29 refers to an exclusive Harvard club. Legend had it that if you did not make your first million by the time you were 40, the club would give it to you. It is to Lowell's eternal credit that against the background of serious mental illness, he continued with his art, and to his even greater credit that in 1959, with an established career, an admired and recognized style, he would recreate his poetry and publish the seminal Life Studies, a collection which inspired, among others, Plath and Anne Sexton, and gave rise to the term confessional poetry. Now, he hated that term, but it's got some justification. One critic described it as ordered bleeding onto the page. My mind's not right, the famous line from Skangar, which again you will hear in a moment, dedicated to Elizabeth Bishop, was true, but the poetry survived it all. The eminent critic Answer once spoke of the two tasks of a writer, the first to create one's style, the second to destroy it. The second is more difficult, and it takes more time. Lowell did it magnificently, but first to his life study of his father, at 19 the old man on the gunboat on the Yangtze, Commander Lowell.
There were no undesirables or girls in my set when I was a boy at Mattapoisett. Only mother, still her father's daughter. Her voice was still electric with a hysterical unmarried panic when she read to me from the Napoleon book. Long-nosed Marie Louise Hopsburg in the frontispiece had a downright Boston bashfulness, where she grovelled to Bonaparte, who scratched his navel and bolted his food, just my 7 years tall. And I, bristling and manic, skulked in the attic and got 200 French generals by name, from A to V, from Augereau to Vandamme. I used to dope myself asleep, naming those unpronounceables like sheep. Having a naval officer for my father was nothing to shout about to the summer colony at Mat. He wasn't at all serious when he showed up on the golf course wearing a blue serge jacket and numbly cut white ducks he'd bought at a Pearl Harbor commissariat, and took 4 shots with his putter to sink his putt. Bob, they said, golf's a game you really ought to know how to play, if you play at all. They wrote him off as naval. Naturally supposed his sport was sailing. Poor father, his training was engineering. Cheerful and cowed among the sea dogs at the Sunday Yacht Club, he was never one of the crowd. Anchors away, Daddy boomed in his bathtub. Anchors away. When Lever Brothers offered to pay him double what the Navy paid, I nagged for his dress sword with gold braid and cringed because mother, new caps on all her teeth, was born anew at 40. With seaman-like celerity, father left the Navy and deeded mother his property. He was soon fired. Year after year, he still hummed Anchors Away in the tub. Whenever he left a job, he bought a smarter car. Father's last employer was Scudder, Stevens, and Clark, investment advisors, himself his only client. While mother dragged to bed alone, read Menninger, and grew more and more suspicious, he grew defiant. Night after night, a la clarté déserte de sa lampe, he slid his ivory Annapolis slide rule across a pad of graphs, piker speculations. In 3 years, he squandered $60,000. Smiling on all, father was once successful enough to be lost in the mob of ruling-class Bostonians. As early as 1928, he owned a house converted to oil and redecorated by the architect of St. Mark's School. Its main effect was a drawing room, longitudinal as Versailles. Its ceiling, roughened with oatmeal, was blue as the sea. And once, 19, the youngest ensign in his class, he was the old man of a gunboat on the Yangtze.
Memories of West Street and Lepke. Only teaching on Tuesdays. Bookworming in pyjamas fresh from the washer each morning. I hog a whole house on Boston's hardly passionate Marlborough Street, where even the man scavenging filth in the back alley trash cans has two children, a beach wagon, a helpmate, and is a young Republican. I have a 9 months daughter, young enough to be my granddaughter. Like the sun, she rises in her flame flamingo infant's wear. These are the tranquilized 50s, and I am 40. Ought I to regret my seed time? I was a fire-breathing Catholic CO and made my manic statement telling off the state and president and then sat waiting sentence in the bullpen beside a Negro boy with curlicues of marijuana in his hair. Given a year, I walked on the roof of the West Street Jail, a short enclosure like my school soccer court, and saw the Hudson River once a day through sooty clothesline entanglements and bleaching khaki tenements. Strolling, I yammered metaphysics with Abramovitz, a jaundice yellow, it's really tan, and flyweight pacifist. So vegetarian, he wore rope shoes and preferred fallen fruit. He tried to convert Beoffen Brown, the Hollywood pimps, to his diet. Hairy, muscular, suburban, wearing chocolate double-breasted suits, they blew their tops and beat in black and blue. I was so out of things, I'd never heard of the Jehovah's Witnesses. Are you a CO? I asked a fellow jailbird. No, he answered, I'm a JW. He taught me the hospital tuck and pointed out the T-shirted back of Murder Incorporated Tsar Lepka, there piling towels on a rack, or dawdling off to his little segregated cell, full of things forbidden to the common man. A portable radio, a dresser, two toy American flags tied together with a ribbon of Easter palm. Flabby, bald, lobotomized, he drifted in a sheepish calm, where no agonizing reappraisal jarred his concentration on the electric chair, hanging like an oasis in his air of lost connections.
Skunk Hour for Elizabeth Bishop. Nautilus Island's hermit heiress still lives through winter in her Spartan cottage. Her sheep still graze above the sea. Her son's a bishop. Her farmer is first selectman in our village. She's in her dotage. Thirsting for the hierarchic privacy of Queen Victoria's century, she buys up all the eyesores facing her shore and lets them fall. The season's ill. We've lost our summer millionaire, who seemed to leap from an L.L. Bean catalog. His nine-knot yawl was auctioned off to lobstermen. A red fox stain covers Blue Hill. And now our fairy decorator brightens his shop for fall, his fishnets filled with orange cork, orange, his cobbler's bench, and all. There is no money in his work. He'd rather marry. One dark night, my Tudor Ford climbed the hill's skull. I watched for love cars. Lights turned down, they lay together, hull to hull, where the graveyard shelves on the town. My mind's not right. A car radio bleats, love, oh careless love. I hear my ill spirit sob in each blood cell, as if my hand were at its throat. I myself am hell. Nobody's here. Only skunks that search in the moonlight for a bite to eat. They march on their souls up Main Street. White stripes, moonstruck eyes, red fire under the chalk dry and spar spire of the Trinitarian Church. I stand on top of our back steps and breathe the rich air. A mother skunk with her column of kittens swills the garbage pail. She jabs her wedge head in a cup of sour cream, drops her ostrich tail, and will not scare.
Waking in the Blue. The night attendant, a BU sophomore, rouses from the mare's nest of his drowsy head, propped on the meaning of meaning. He catwalks down our corridor. Azure day makes my agonized blue window bleaker. Crows maunder on the petrified highway. Absence. My hearts grow tense, as though a harpoon was sparring for the kill. This is the house for the mentally ill. What use is my sense of humor? I grin at Stanley, now sunk in his 60s, once a Harvard All-American fullback, if such were possible. Still hoarding the build of a boy in his 20s, as he soaks a ramrod with a muscle of a seal in his long tub, vaguely urinous from the Victorian plumbing. A kingly granite profile in a crimson gold cap, worn all day, all night. He thinks only of his figure, of slimming on sherbet and ginger ale, more cut off from words than a seal. This is the way day breaks in Bowditch Hall at McLean's. The hooded nightlights bring out Bobby, porcelain 29, a replica of Louis XIV without the wig, redolent and roly-poly as a sperm whale, as he swashbuckles around in his birthday suit and horses at chairs. These victorious figures of bravado ossified young. In between the limits of day, hours and hours go by under the crew haircuts and slightly too little nonsensical bachelor twinkle of the Roman Catholic attendants. There are no Mayflower screwballs in the Catholic Church. After a hearty New England breakfast, I weigh 200 pounds this morning. Cock of the walk, I strut in my turtle-necked French sailor's jersey before the metal shaving mirrors and see the shaky future grow familiar in the pinched indigenous faces of these thoroughbred mental cases, twice my age and half my weight. We're all old-timers. Each of us holds a locked razor.
For the Union dead. Excuse me. The old South Boston Aquarium stands in a Sahara of snow now. Its broken windows are boarded. The bronze weathervane cod has lost half its scales. The airy tanks are dry. Once my nose crawled like a snail on the glass. My hand tingled to burst the bubbles drifting from the noses of the cowed, compliant fish. My hand draws back. I often sigh still for the dark, downward, and vegetating kingdom of the fish and reptile. One morning last March, I pressed against the new barbed and galvanized fence on the Boston Common. Behind their cage, yellow dinosaur steam shovels were grunting as they cropped up tons of mush and grass to gouge their underworld garage. Parking spaces luxuriate like civic sandpiles in the heart of Boston. A girdle of orange, Puritan, pumpkin-colored girders braces the tingling statehouse, shaking over the excavations as it faces Colonel Shaw and his bell-cheeked Negro infantry on St. Gaudens' shaking Civil War relief, propped by a plank splint against the garage's earthquake. 2 months after marching through Boston, half the regiment was dead. At the dedication, William James could almost hear the bronze Negroes breathe. Their monument sticks like a fishbone in the city's throat. Its colonel is as lean as a compass needle. He has an angry, wren-like vigilance, a greyhound's gently tautness. He seems to wince at pleasure and suffocate for privacy. He is out of bounds now. He rejoices in man's lovely, peculiar power to choose life and die. When he leads his black soldiers to death, he cannot bend his back. On 1,000 small-town New England greens, The old white churches hold their air of sparse, sincere rebellion. Frayed flags quilt the graveyards of the Grand Army of the Republic. The stone statues of the abstract Union soldier grow slimmer and younger each year. Wasp-waisted, they doze over muskets and muse through their sideburns. Shaw's father wanted no monument except the ditch where his son's body was thrown and lost with his niggers. The ditch is nearer. There are no statues for the last war here. On Boylston Street, a commercial photograph shows Hiroshima boiling over a Mosler safe, the rock of ages that survived the blast. Space is nearer. When I crouch to my television set, the drained faces of Negro schoolchildren rise like balloons. Colonel Shaw is riding on his bubble. He waits for the blessed break. The aquarium is gone. Everywhere, giant finned cars nose forward like fish. A savage servility slides by on Greece.
Why don't they say what I want them to say about me? Robert Lowell to a friend. What's that? That I'm heartbreaking. He was indeed. Robert Lowell married three times, three brilliant women, all writers. Jean Stafford, successful short story writer. The dazzling Elizabeth Hardwick, American literary icon, who died this year. They were married for 27 years of intense passion, intense agony, her line. His illness and unfaithfulness, sometimes morally and in every other way, fatally mixed. He left Elizabeth Hardwick in 1970 and became visiting fellow at All Souls, Oxford, lecturer at Kent and Essex. He left his wife for the stunningly beautiful, equally fragile, Booker Prize-winning novelist Caroline Blackwood. It was never going to work. I'm manic, Caroline's panic. In Last Walk, heartbreaking poem, last week on to them all, 7 years now, nothing but a diverting smile. All this pain was examined in his Pulitzer Prize-winning collection, The Dolphin, a poetic Bergman-esque scenes from marriage, which his friend Elizabeth Bishop begged him not to publish. Particularly the poems, very short poems, Exorcism 1 and 2, which quote letters from Elizabeth Hardwick. It's a troubling area morally, he agreed. You want the reader to say this is true, and continued, truthfulness is an aesthetic effect. Dolphin, the poem, is an ambiguous plea for forgiveness. However, he wrote, I'm tired. Everyone's tired of my turmoil. Lowell had a brilliant ear for the rage and ecstasy of human sexuality. Heaney, the normally gentle Heaney, much admires the last brutal lines of Man and Wife, which describe the woman's tirade as it breaks over the man, Lowell, as they lie in mother's bed. Parche Thomas Middleton, it's mothers, beware mothers. Well, as Eliot wrote, our beginnings never know our ends. Robert Lowell died in a taxi in New York in 1977. He was just 61. He was on his way back from England to Elizabeth Hardwick, having left Caroline Blackwood. He was carrying a parcel. It contained a portrait of Caroline Blackwood by Lucian Freud, to whom she had been married, and Gray Gowrie had procured it for Lowell years earlier. The last poem you hear this evening is one of the last he wrote, its epilogue, and it reminds us, we are poor passing facts, warned by that to give each figure in the photograph his living name. But first to Man and Wife.
Tamed by Milltown, we lie on mother's bed. The rising sun in war paint dyes us red. In broad daylight her gilded bedposts shine, abandoned, almost Dionysian. At last the trees are green on Marlborough Street. Blossoms on our magnolia ignite the morning with their murderous 5 days white. All night I've held your hand, as if you had a fourth time faced the kingdom of the mad, its hackneyed speech, its homicidal eye, and dragged me home alive. Oh, my petite, clearest of all God's creatures, still all air and nerve. You were in your 20s, and I, once hand on glass and heart in mouth, outdrank the raves in the heat of Greenwich Village, fainting at your feet. too boiled and shy and poke a face to make a pass, while the shrill verve of your invective scorched the traditional South. Now 12 years later, you turn your back. Sleepless, you hold your pillow to your hollows like a child. Your old-fashioned tirade, loving, rapid, merciless, breaks like the Atlantic Ocean on my head. Exorcism Part 1. What we love, we are. As November hardens the morning hoarfrost, I grow small. Slowly the bridal fury shows white teeth, parading in invisible link mail. Greenness slurs into sterility. The landscape is New England textile grey. You point your finger. What you love, you are. I know what it is for a woman to be left to wait in the anteroom of apprehension. Inasmuch as I am loved, I am. A woman romanticizing her exorcist. Two souls in a cocoon of mystery. Your woman dances for you, child in arms. She is dancing for you, baby skull smile. Exorcism Part 2. This morning, as if I were home in Boston, snow the pure witchery bitchery of kindergarten winters. My window whitens like a movie screen, glaring, specked, excluding rival outlook. I can throw what I want on this blank screen, but only the show already chosen shows. Melodrama with her stiletto heel dancing bullet wounds in the parquet. My words are English, but the plot is hexed. One man, two women, the common novel plot. What you love, you are. You can't carry your talent with you like a suitcase. Don't you dare mail us the love your life denies. Do you really know what you have done?
Dolphin. My dolphin, you only guide me by surprise, captive as Racine, the man of craft, drawn through his maze of iron composition by the incomparable wandering voice of Phaedra. When I was troubled in mind, you made for my body, caught in its hangman's knot of sinking lines, the glassy bowing and scraping of my will. I have sat and listened to too many words of the collaborating muse, and plotted perhaps too freely with my life, not avoiding injury to others, not avoiding injury to myself, to ask compassion. This book, half fiction, an eel net made by man for the eel fighting. My eyes have seen what my hand did. Epilogue. Those blessed structures, plot and rhyme, why are they no help to me now? I want to make something imagined, not recalled. I hear the noise of my own voice. The painter's vision is not a lens. It trembles to caress the light. But sometimes everything I write with the threadbare art of my eye seems a snapshot, lurid, rapid, garish, grouped, heightened from life, yet paralyzed by fact. All's misalliance. Yet why not say what happened? Pray for the grace of accuracy Vermeer gave to the sun's illumination, stealing like the tide across a map to his girl, solid with yearning. We are poor passing facts, warned by that to give each figure in the photograph his living name.
On March 26, 1959, a dinner was held at the Waldorf Astoria, New York, to honor Robert Frost on his 85th birthday. Lion Trilling, the eminent critic, rose to speak. I have to say that my Frost is not the Frost I seem to perceive in the minds of so many of his admirers. He is not the Frost who reassures us by his affirmation of old virtues, old simplicities and ways of feeling. He is anything but. Frost's poems, best poems, represent the terrible actualities of life. In some, he is a terrifying poet. Frost was disconcerted. The audience was disconcerted. Trilling left almost immediately, but Trilling was right. For beneath the guise of the avuncular Robert Frost was the poet of terror and of the terrible necessity of courage, knowing as he did that life can beat the best of us down. In his own scalding line, the saddest thing in life is that the best thing in it should be courage. Well, he needed it. He needed it when he was young, and he needed it when he was old. Robert Lee Frost, named after the famous general, was born in 1874 in San Francisco. His father was William Frost, East Coast, Harvard-educated journalist, aspiring politician, who'd gone west to pursue his ambitions. Alas, for all his charm, Will was an alcoholic and a gambler, and he died at the tragically early age of 34 of pulmonary disease. After funeral expenses, his wife, Belle, was left with $8 in the bank. She had no alternative but to ask her father-in-law to take herself and her children back to Boston and to pay the fare. Belle, in whose family ran a fatal strain of mental illness, was of Scottish descent, a teacher and a published religious poet. She eventually got a job teaching in a small apartment where every night she would read poetry to her children, Jeannie and Robert, as Frost would with his own children. Education by poetry, he called it, our mantra. Frost was a brilliant scholar. John Updike notes he knew more Greek and Latin than either Eliot or Pound. However, in his poetry, it's virtually devoid of classical reference, though when you get to his dramatic monologues, which I advise you all to read, the note is pure Greek tragedy. He went to Dartmouth, then to Harvard. His tough New England grandfather demanded an account of every cent of the $5 a week living expenses he allowed him. Frost would later write, "No man was ever meant to remember or invent what he did with every cent." After 2 years, he left, partly to help his mother. He worked as a teacher, a cobbler, and a farmer. When his first real poem, My Butterfly, the writing of which he described as like cutting along a nerve, was published in 1894 in the prestigious Independent newspaper, the editor noted, "There is a secret genius between the lines." Frost determined on poetry for life. In his own words, "Inflexible ambition trains us best." Amazingly, his grandfather offered to support him for a year. "No," said Frost, "it will take me 20. It did. He wrote the poetry, beautiful poems. No one was interested. The Atlantic Monthly: "We regret the Atlantic has no place for your vigorous verse, Mr. Frost." Eventually, he sold his farm in Derry, New Hampshire, and moved to Buckinghamshire, England, where his first collection, A Boy's Will, was published in 1913, followed a year later by North of Boston, to huge acclaim. Frost had returned to America. He'd left it almost unknown, and he turned celebrated in his 40s. From then on, there was no stopping him. He won 4 Pulitzer Prizes, a record that still stands. He would, even in late life, attract crowds of over 10,000. The cool Miss Marianne Moore, not given to hyperbole, said he was the best speaker she ever heard. Allen Ginsberg said Robert Frost literally created an audience for poetry reading. "I teach myself," he said, "my own take on the world. I just sit there radiating poetry." Though he was orthodox in politics, a liberal, he once said, is someone who won't take his own side in an argument, President Kennedy invited him to read at his inauguration. Frost had planned to read aloud a new poem. He typed a copy. The sun glare reflecting off the heavy snow made that impossible. So Frost recited from memory The Gift outright. It had been written 30 years earlier, but it was perfect. So what is it in his poetry that made him from such hard beginnings a literary and a public icon? Well, he probably best embodies Eliot's dictum that poetry is one person talking to another. "If, when you read my poem," Frost said, "you heard a voice, That would be to my liking. The gold and the ore is the sound. A poem begins in delight and ends in wisdom. The same as for love. It is a momentary stay against confusion. Then he said, I want to trip my readers into the boundless. And therein, I think, lies the terror. The undernote in the short poems you're about to hear, acquainted with the night, bereft, fire and ice, desert places. Harold Brodsky, Nobel laureate, spoke of frosts as a signal from a far distant station. The fuel, grief and reason. Of mending wall, Seamus Heaney said, it reiterated Frost's belief in his rights to limits, to defences, limits he needed, knowing he could so easily fall into the abyss. It is a poem of deceptive simplicity. Never take a fence down, he said, until you know why it was put up. In 1962, Frost was asked by Kennedy to visit Khrushchev in Moscow to plead against the construction of the Berlin Wall. It didn't work, but Mending Wall is the poem this master of metaphor, with considerable cunning, recited at the official dinner in Moscow. Out, out is, from Outbreed Candle, shocks on every level. It tells the true story of the death of a neighbor's child in a sawmill, the awful imagery of the boy's arm leaping towards the saw. Neither refuse the meeting. And if there is a truer or tougher last line in literature than the one you will hear at the end of Out, Out, then please send it to me. Anyway, first to Acquainted with the Night.
I have been one acquainted with the night. I have walked out in rain and back in rain. I have outwalked the furthest city light. I have looked down the saddest city lane. I have passed by the watchman on his beat and dropped my eyes, unwilling to explain. I have stood still and stopped the sound of feet when far away an interrupted cry came over houses from another street, but not to call me back or say goodbye. And further still, at an unearthly height, one luminary clock against the sky proclaimed the time was neither wrong nor right. I have been one acquainted with the night. Bereft. Where had I heard this wind before change like this to a deeper roar? What would it take my standing there for, holding open a restive door, looking downhill to a frothy shore? Summer was past, and the day was past. Somber clouds in the west were massed. Out on the porch's sagging floor, leaves got up in a coil and hissed, blindly striking at my knee and missed. Something sinister in the tone told me my secret may be known. Word I was in the house alone somehow must have gotten abroad. Word I was in my life alone. Word I had no one left but God.
Fire and ice. Some say the world will end in fire. Some say in ice. From what I've tasted of desire, I hold with those who favor fire. But if it had to perish twice, I think I know enough of hate to say that for destruction, ice is also great and would suffice. Desert places. Snow falling and night falling fast. Oh, fast, in a field I looked into going past, and the ground almost covered smooth in snow, but a few weeds and stubble showing last. The woods around it have it. It is theirs. All animals are smothered in their lairs. I am too absent-spirited to count. The loneliness includes me unawares. And lonely as it is, that loneliness will be more lonely ere it will be less. A blanker whiteness of benighted snow with no expression, nothing to express. They cannot scare me with their empty spaces between stars, on stars where no human race is, I have it in me, so much nearer home, to scare myself with my own desert places.
The gift outright. The land was ours before we were the land. She was our land more than 100 years before we were her people. She was ours in Massachusetts, in Virginia. But we were England's, still colonials, possessing what we still were unpossessed by, possessed by what we now no more possessed. Something we were withholding made us weak until we found out that it was ourselves we were withholding from our land of living, and forthwith found salvation in surrender. Such as we were, we gave ourselves outright. The deed of gift was many deeds of war. To the land, vaguely realizing westward, but still unstoried, artless, unenhanced, such as she was, such as she would become. Mending wall. Something there is that doesn't love a wall that sends the frozen groundswell under it and spills the upper boulders in the sun and makes gaps even two can pass abreast. The work of hunters is another thing. I have come after them and made repair where they have left not one stone on a stone, but they would have the rabbit out of hiding to please the yelping dogs. The gaps, I mean, no one has seen them made or heard them made, but at spring mending time we find them there. I let my neighbor know beyond the hill, and on a day we meet to walk the line and set the wall between us once again. We keep the wall between us as we go, to each the boulders that have fallen to each, and some are loaves and some so nearly balls, we have to use a spell to make them balance. Stay where you are until our backs are turned. We wear our fingers rough with handling them. Oh, just another kind of outdoor game, one on a side. It comes to little more. There where it is, we do not need the wall. He is all pine, and I am apple orchard. My apple trees will never get across and eat the cones under his pines, I tell him. He only says, good fences make good neighbors. Spring is the mischief in me, and I wonder if I could put a notion in his head. Why do they make good neighbors? Isn't it where there are cows? But here there are no cows. Before I built a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out, and to whom I was like to give offense. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down. I could say elves to him, but it's not elves exactly, and I'd rather he said it for himself. I see him there bringing a stone grasped firmly by the top in each hand like an old stone savage armed. He moves in darkness, as it seems to me, not of woods only, and the shade of trees. He will not go behind his father's saying, and he likes having thought of it so well, he says again. Good fences make good neighbors.
Out, out. The buzzsaw snarled and rattled in the yard and made dust and dropped stove-length sticks of wood. Sweet-scented stuff when the breeze drew across it. And from there, those that lifted eyes could count 5 mountain ranges, one behind the other, under the sunset far into Vermont. And the saw snarled and rattled as it ran light or had to bear a load. And nothing happened. Day was all but done. Call it a day, I wish they might have said, to please the boy by giving him the half hour that a boy counts so much when saved from work. His sister stood beside him in her apron to tell them supper. At the word, the saw, as if it meant to prove saws know what supper meant, leapt out at the boy's hand, or seemed to leap. He must have given the hand. However it was, neither refused the meeting. but the hand. The boy's first outcry was a rueful laugh as he swung toward them, holding up the hand, half in appeal, but half as if to keep the life from spilling. Then the boy saw all, since he was old enough to know. Big boy, doing a man's work, though a child at heart. He saw all was spoiled. "Don't let him cut my hand off. The doctor, when he comes, don't let him, sister." So, the hand was gone already. The doctor put him in the dark of ether. He lay and puffed his lips out with his breath. And then the watcher at his pulse took a fright. No one believed. They listened to his heart. Little, less, nothing. And that ended it. No more to build on there. And they, since they were not the one dead, turned to their affairs.
Quite extraordinary poem, I think. Absolutely devastating. Robert Frost fell in love early and passionately and brought all his will to bear in pursuit of Eleanor White, with whom he shared top honours at his school. When she left for St. Lawrence University, he was racked with terror and jealousy that he would lose her. He decided to do something dramatic and had printed two copies of poetry he'd written on handmade paper, stamped in gold. Remember, he had very little money. He travelled to St. Lawrence to make his declaration. Eleanor did not respond to this deeply romantic act. And when he received what he thought was a dismissive letter from her, he was utterly distraught. He destroyed his copy and he disappeared for days into the Virginia swamps. He survived. He persevered. And, listeners, he married her. He was 21. She was 23. Let the affection be deep. It can only be for one person. Theirs was a temperamental mismatch, alas. And it was a marriage that was racked with tragedy. He was a loving father, though he ruefully noted, a mother is always a Democrat with her sons, and a father is always a Republican. However, in an almost Job-like sequence of tragedy, his son Elliot died when he was 4, another daughter in infancy, another Marjorie, having successfully fought off serious mental illness, maternal genetic inheritance, which we spoke of earlier, succumbed to a puerperal fever with her first child. In 1938, his beloved Eleanor died. He was literally mad with grief. This is his Lear-like description. "I cannot touch my mind with a memory of any kind. I cannot touch my skin." He was also consumed with guilt. She was too frail for the life he'd given to her due to his ruthless ambition. Too many children. There's a terrible line in one of his poems called Home Burial. "God damn me when he gets round to it." His suffering was not over. 2 years later, his son Carol shot himself. "I feel," he said, "as though I am laid out upon a cross." Robert Frost did fall in love again with the married Kay Morrison, his assistant. Beautiful, cool, with a bevy of admirers. No one has established impropriety, but he was fascinated by her. The short poems with which we end include one of the most beautiful, Brian and I were saying this, beautiful love lyrics in the language. "Never again would bird's song be the same," and again with one of the loveliest last lines. I won't spoil it for you. Then we have "Two Meet Two," haunting again. His oft-quoted "The Road Not Taken" was inspired by Edward Thomas's indecision as to which path to take during their walks in Buckinghamshire. It's a metaphor for life. We end with "Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening," its iconic last lines often quoted by Kennedy in his speeches. Kennedy, of course, who had far fewer miles to go than any of us imagined. Robert Frost died on January the 28th, 1963, aged 88. "I would have written of me on my stone, I had a lover's quarrel with the world." Lovely poem.
"Never again would bird song be the same." Or did I jump the gun here? I did. It's Two Look at Two. I'm sorry.
Two Look at Two. Love and forgetting might have carried them a little further up the mountainside with night so near, but not much further up. They must have halted soon in any case with thoughts of a path back. How rough it was with rock and washout and unsafe in darkness when they were halted by a tumbled wall with barbed wire binding. They stood facing this, spending what onward impulse they still had in one last look, the way they must not go, on up the falling path, where if a stone or earth slide moved at night, it moved itself. No footstep moved it. This is all, they sighed. Good night to woods. But not so. There was more. A doe from round a spruce stood looking at them, across the wall, as near the wall as they. She saw them in their field, they her in hers. The difficulty of seeing what stood still, like some upended boulder split in two, was in her clouded eyes. They saw no fear there. She seemed to think that two thus they were safe. Then, as if they were something that, though strange, she could not trouble her mind with too long, she sighed and passed unscared along the wall. This, then, is all. What more is there to ask? But no, not yet. A snort to bid them wait. A buck from round the spruce stood looking at them, across the wall, as near the wall as they. This was an antlered buck of lusty nostril, not the same doe come back into her place. He viewed them quizzically with jerks of head, as if to ask, why don't you make some motion, or give some sign of life? Because you can't. I doubt if you're as living as you look. Thus, till he had them almost feeling dared to stretch a proffering hand and a spell breaking, then he too passed unscared along the wall. Two had seen two, whichever side you spoke from. This must be all. It was all. Still they stood, a great wave from it going over them, as if the earth, in one unlooked-for favour, had made them certain earth returned their love.
Never again would birdsong be the same. Am I right?
Yes. Yes.
I don't trust myself anymore. He would declare, and could himself believe, that the birds there in all the garden round, from having heard the day-long voice of Eve, had added to their own an oversound, her tone of meaning, but without the words. Admittedly, an eloquence so soft could only have had an influence on birds when call or laughter carried it aloft. Be that as may be, she was in their song. Moreover, her voice upon their voices crossed had now persisted in the woods so long that probably it never would be lost. Never again would bird song be the same. And to do that to birds was why she came.
The road not taken. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood. And sorry I could not travel both and be one traveller, long I stood, and looked down one, as far as I could, to where it bent in the undergrowth. Then took the other, as just as fair, and having, perhaps, the better claim, because it was grassy, and wanted wear. Though as for that, the passing there had warned them really about the same. And both, that morning, equally lay, in leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first, for another day. Yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by. And that has made all the difference.
Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near, between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there is some mistake. The only other sound's the sweep of the easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep and miles to go before I sleep and miles to go before I sleep.
That's it, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you. Thank you both.